and the graduate program director of an MA and PhD program focusing on critical disability studies at York University in Toronto. Marcia's been an advisor to federal and provincial commissions, parliamentary committees, and international NGOs, as well as UN agencies. She's edited a number of collected volumes and nearly 70 book chapters and articles on disability rights. And Marcia's going to be presenting to us today on the regional context of inequality in early childhood education in the slums of Mumbai.
Thank you very much. I also am very thrilled to be invited here. I very much appreciate the invitation, and I'm finding the 2 or 3 days here absolutely stimulating, so thank you very much. And all those people who organized deserve a lot of credit for that. I want to say that I'm going to start by just framing my discussion of Mumbai, which is a microcosm, to within a broader context of equity generally. Now, if I can just figure out what I do here. Okay. I think as we're seeing, there a recent development in understanding education is to conceptualize it from the perspective of human rights. So that is putting it in a framework of social justice. It's not just about teaching, or it's not just about education. It's actually a much broader issue. However, it's by no means certain that the entitlement to education as a human right is able in any way to defeat the overbearing technology and pedagogical theory that has become the evidence base to judge the capacity of children to learn and the ability of people to participate in our current education system. Added to this are the public attitudes that reflect a hegemonic economic analysis favoring the idea that the economic well-being of nations is dependent on schools training a productive labor force. I think we had a lot of discussion around that yesterday, actually. This is furthered by the privatization of schools in many countries, which has in some cases resulted in class-based, race-based, and ableism segregation in those schools. These are powerful inhibitors to the right to education for those who are different. So difference has then been used to marginalize many in the school industry. However, we have some very clear directives in terms of right to education. We know that there are economic, social, and environmental issues which affect what happens in education, and I'll talk about those, particularly what happened in the Mumbai slums. It's not just about access to school. This is clear if we look at the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Rights of Women, the Convention on People with Disability, the Social, Economic, Cultural Rights. They all talk about education as a fundamental right. But I just want to note quickly that our literacy rates are actually abysmal in the OECD countries as well. So if we look at Canada, we can see some poor rates generally and surprising rates of illiteracy among marginalized groups. And this is from a recent study which we just finished on literacy and disability. You can see that less than grade 9, using the simple measures, and I think there are lots of better measures for literacy, but just using the simple measure of grade 9 completion, 10% of people age 20 and over in Canada are illiterate. And you can see the distinction between the East and the West. I mean, the inequity is so obvious, and the North as well, where we really see outrageous rates. There are strong differences among the various types of literacy, and again, strong differences across the country from province to province. In terms of people with disabilities, the rate at which people with disabilities have less than grade 9 was nearly triple the rate of people without disabilities. So when we're talking about equity, even in the West, we have some really serious issues. If we use a human rights approach related to equity, education is influenced by a variety of factors. Using human rights, we have to look at pedagogical theory and what's happening with our pedagogical theory. How does it actually lead to inequity rather than equity? We need to look at access to places of learning and the types of places to learning that people get into. We certainly need to look at the testing capacity in terms of deciding that people are succeeding or not succeeding. We need to look at how we measure success in terms of success of students within the school system. In Toronto, if you go to the Eaton Centre on most days, you'll see, 10,000 kids hanging out there. It says something about what we think our success rate is. So we need to make human rights principles integral to the design, to the implementation, and to the evaluation of policies and programs. But let me tell you the story of India and the slums of Mumbai. This project started out actually as a development project. It was funded throughout by CETA Canada. It started out as a program to get kids with disabilities into preschool. Well, actually, the idea was to get them into primary school, but we had to get them through preschool so they could pass the qualification to get into the primary schools. We found that we had about an average of about 50 kids in each of our classes. We started out by simply developing the methodology by which we would try to do this. We moved on from there because we were asked by CETA, my partner in India, Dr. Meetu Alur, and I were asked to actually do a study to show whether, in fact, we'd been successful and to use all the conventional measures to show whether we were successful in our work, all those figures. So what we found was there were a number of things that were effective in terms of interventions. One was an initial commitment to inclusion by the people we were working with. The second was to involve the whole community, and to do that we had to have an ecological curriculum grounded in cultural norms and values, similar to what you were talking about, Jessica. We found there needed to be an emphasis on accessibility because we were dealing with kids with disabilities. We found there had to be capacity building and training of inclusive staff who understood the idea of having both kids with and without disabilities in the classrooms. And we had to do what we began to call deprofessionalization. All that industry of people who do rehabilitation around kids with disabilities, we needed to move them towards understanding that this was about education. It wasn't about treatment of kids with disabilities. We had about 50 kids in the classes, and we had about 5 to 10% with disabilities. We knew that one of the things we had to do was we had to use the structure which already existed. So there was no point in us having ratios of 1 to 10 or 1 to 20 or even 1 to 30. We knew that when we finished doing this, there would still be 50 kids in those preschool early childhood development classes. So we decided to use the conditions that existed in the slum areas. Now, we were working with, our research was on 6 of the sites that we had. And we were working, we had to work with the community itself, which involved everybody from the parents to the slumlords. You don't wander into the slums of India unless you've already negotiated that you're going to be there because the school won't work otherwise. So we worked in 5 areas. They're all slum areas. A couple of them were in Dharavi, which you would probably all know. It's said to be the largest slum in Southeast Asia. But we also were working, and that's a regulated slum. We were also working in a number of unregulated slums, so we would sometimes go in and half the slum would be bulldozed by the city, and we'd have to start a bit again. But we were working with both because we wanted to see if this actually worked for all kinds of areas. Now, we had... we went through the sites. I'll just give you some photographs of the sites so that you can get an idea of the kinds of places we were working, although I won't talk particularly. I can tell you that the average number of people in the families was somewhere between 5 and 7, most people worked in some kind of micro-industries. The homes were... There was almost nobody who had any washrooms in the homes or any kind of facilities like that. The homes were usually, sizes, but probably the size of this kind of area. And we had our classrooms were about a similar size. So you had a spot for each of the 50 kids on the floor, but that was it. So we did all the things you need to do to see how well you're doing. We did development indicators to look to how the children learned. We did developmental scales. We did over a two-year period, pre, mid, and post. We did all of those things that it's very important to do to prove that you're actually something's happening to the kids. We developed a scale called the Barriers to Inclusion Scale, which arose from teachers, parents, classrooms, and physical environment. So we developed that scale so we could see if we were actually seeing some changes for the kids with disabilities. And we had a parental attitude survey. We looked at results from all of those to try to find out what happened. And I think there were. I'm not going to go through all those and give you all the statistics about those particular characteristics that we found. Overall, we can say that for the kids with disabilities and without disabilities, we saw very strong gains in the functional skill of independence. We saw very strong gains in the communication. We saw very large, for both kids with and without disabilities, we saw gains in every one of our development factors. We also saw changes in the attitudes of parents. As they came into the school and stayed in the school, they got much more used to the idea that kids with disabilities could study with their children. So they started to gain confidence. We actually had about 90% attendance throughout, but we had one teacher who we'd trained, an Anguinati worker, and an assistant teacher. And if kids didn't show up, we went to see why they didn't come. So they stayed in the school. We saw many classes that were empty that weren't our schools, but in fact the kids were in the schools and they were in the school year after year. What the parents wanted was their kids would learn something that they hadn't learned, couldn't learn at home. That was their key indicator. And they wanted English. And they wanted to make sure that the children could get into the first grade so that they eventually could have a job. So those were the kinds of things that parents were telling us they really wanted. The most significant environmental change was in the behavior of the Anguinati multi-purpose workers. This was with regard to both children with and without disabilities. We looked at their capacity to manage the class. We looked at their facility at inclusion at multiple levels. We looked at capacity to address the needs of children with disabilities, and we saw increases in all of those for the workers. And we trained them ourselves, actually. And parental attitudes changed quite significantly. I'm getting on the two-minute signal. Changed quite significantly. So let me just go to what we think are the success factors in getting these kids into school, getting them out of school, and getting them into first grade. We were able to get almost all the children into regular schools in first grade. This is one of our schools, just so you have an idea of how fancy our schools were. And on the left is the smokestack that was blowing the smoke into the school. I'm trying to get to the next. So what did we find out about how we would make this successful, how to make this successful? Well, there are a number of things. One was, and we would call them key inclusion indicators. One is a belief in the inclusion by parents, families, and communities. That meant working with those communities before we went in. We didn't walk in and set up schools. What we did was we worked with the community. We did environmental or ecological assessments. We developed all our training tools from the neighborhood so that we didn't actually use Barbie dolls and Dick and Jane and Spot. We used materials that came from there. Most of the materials were either made by mothers or made by the teachers themselves. We had a whole of community approach, which was grounded in the community. It was sensitive about disability and workers, about the community. We did an ecological curriculum based on unique identities of each of the communities, so they were slightly different for each of the communities. We did major capacity building of the Anguinati multi-purpose workers to ensure that they understood what we were trying to do. We did outreach and awareness, which included support and ownership in the family, and the community was engaged in the process all the way through, and that means everybody in the community. You know, the little meetings we would have as we'd go in one day and the slumlord was there. We met with him then for an hour or two to make sure that we could carry on and continue with our work. There was a strong emphasis on accessibility, both physically and pedagogically. And that was important and not easy. It was very difficult. So our interventions were in three key areas: the classroom, the specialist or support roles, and the community. And we looked at interventions in all of those three areas in terms of setting up the schools. And as I say, just about all the kids got into first grade, which was really our criteria for success, but it was also that they actually were ready to learn at that stage. What it did show was we can have inclusive education, even in what are probably the worst possible conditions that you can imagine in terms of numbers, capacity, teaching materials, and all of those criteria which are normally used. We were actually able to meet them all and had children learning.
Thank you.